Coming up on this week's Book Show, Ruth Reichel is an award-winning journalist honored with 6 James Beard Awards for her journalism, magazine feature writing, and criticism. Her latest book, Save Me the Plums, chronicles her groundbreaking tenure as editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. Ruth Reichel on this week's Book Show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Ruth Reichel is an award-winning journalist honored with 6 James Beard Awards for her journalism, magazine feature writing, and criticism. She's also the author of the memoirs Tender at the Bone, Comfort Me with Apples, Garlic and Sapphires, and the cookbook My Kitchen Year. Her latest book, Save Me the Plums, is subtitled My Gourmet Memoir. It chronicles her groundbreaking tenure as editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. The book is also a commentary on the revolutionary world of food from 1999 to 2009, and the story of Reichel as, she says, a former Berkeley hippie learning to be a boss of many people. It is a great pleasure to welcome Ruth Reichel to this week's Book Show. How are you?
I'm great. I'm very happy to see you again.
It's wonderful to see you again. Well, I've loved your writing, and it just seemed, for those of us who have been watching and observing your career, that it was inevitable that you were going to write about your time at Gourmet, but you took your time.
I always knew I would do this book, and in fact, from the time that I got to Gourmet, every day I would print out 3 or 4 emails that I had gotten during the day, just so I would have a record in real time of what was going on. I mean, it could be anything, you know, things that my publisher sent me or a writer sent. I knew that I was going to want to be able to stick my finger back in and be in that moment again. Unlike many of my other books, this one I was really well prepared for.
Well prepared for, and yet you knew that some time had to pass.
I did. I was really upset, depressed. I felt guilty when the magazine closed. And I knew I had to give myself some space. I had always said, well, you know, if I didn't have a day job, I would write a novel. I tried to write a novel, but I was in such a bad place that what I ended up doing really was cooking. And then I decided I would write a book about that year of cooking and how cooking had pretty much saved my life. And so these 2 books got in between the memoir. And suddenly a long time had passed, and, you know, there I was looking back, not so much with anger, but with awe and gratitude for having been given the opportunity to try and make the best Epicurean magazine that I possibly could.
At what point did Gourmet and ultimately Cy Newhouse come sniffing around saying, oh, we would like you?
I had been at the New York Times as the restaurant critic for 6 years, and out of the blue, I mean, just completely unexpected, I get this call from James Truman, who was the editorial director of Condé Nast, but to be honest, I had never heard of him. It was very funny because he said, would you meet me for tea? I'd ask you to the office, but we don't want anyone to know that we've been talking. And I thought, what is he talking about? Why? I mean, I was really so clueless as to the world of Condé Nast that I didn't know that they thought, and not without reason, it turned out, that the eyes of the world were constantly trained on them, and that if anybody saw me going into Condé Nast, tongues would start wagging. I was so clueless that I actually thought he wanted to offer me a job as a restaurant critic.
At what point was it revealed to you that, okay, you would be taking over the job, and the nature of why you would be taking over the job?
You know, the whole thing was kind of mysterious, because first I have this meeting with James, and he says, we think you would make a very good editor-in-chief for Gourmet. And I said, you're out of your mind. I mean, I love that magazine. I had loved the magazine since I was a little girl. I loved the idea that they really wanted to change it and make it better. But I certainly didn't think I was the one to do it. I mean, I had no magazine experience except as a freelance writer. I'd never been a boss, never told people what to do. I'm really bad with money and budgets. And I mean, at one point, I actually pulled out my checkbook and said, look, I can't even balance my checkbook. What makes you think that I could, you know? But I told him what I thought a great Epicurean magazine could be. I mean, this was 1999, and I sort of got up on my high horse and said, you know, American food is in this wonderful place right now, and magazine should reflect it, and it should be leading the conversation. He said, well, you know, think about it. And I said, well, I'm not going to think about being the editor-in-chief, but you think about what the magazine could be and how great it could be for America to have an Epicurean magazine that does more than just deal with recipes and reservations. He called me a little bit later and said, you know, you have such interesting ideas. Would you be willing to meet with the owner of Condé Nast, Cy Newhouse? I was very puffed up with my own importance. I thought, you know, the head of Condé Nast wants to hear my ideas. he said, you know, your ideas are interesting, and I'd love for you to tell them to him. So at that point, I go and I have lunch with Cy Newhouse. And in the course of the lunch, becomes very clear to me that he has absolutely no interest in listening to my ideas. As I'm leaving, I basically blurt out, why did you invite me to lunch? And he says, I think you'd be a great editor-in-chief for Gourmet. And we did this funny dance where I kept saying, no, I really don't want to do it. And he kept saying, I'm convinced that you would do a good job. You know, there is nothing more appealing to extremely wealthy people than being told no. I mean, especially for Cy, who loved the game. He loved the business, the persuading, the winning. And so he set out to make sure that I would take this job.
I want to talk about that relationship in a moment, but when you come on, because you had shared your ideas of what you thought this magazine could be, when you arrived, it was in what state? What did you think of it at that point?
As a very young girl, I had discovered Gourmet. It had literally changed my life. It had opened up the world of food to me. It had made me think that food was really important and that it was about relationships. It was about getting to know other cultures, that it was about travel. It had made me think that food was a way of looking at the world. I felt that it had become quite stodgy over time. In the early days of Gourmet, they had wonderful writers. I mean, you know, M.F.K. Fisher wrote for it. Annie Proulx wrote for the magazine. Ray Bradbury's Dandelion Wine started as an article in Gourmet. They had Ruth Harkness, who was the woman who went to China to bring back the first panda. I mean, alone. Right. She wrote for the magazine. They had these intrepid adventurers. And I felt that it had become a grand dame, sort of self-satisfied, and that it had lost that sense of adventure. For me, food was just opening up, and what was happening in American food was, you know, we were looking at Asia and South America, and Gourmet was still very invested in looking to Europe. When they did travel stories, they tended to be about cruises and staying in resorts. So I really thought that it was a magazine for rich people. I thought that young people were suddenly interested in food and that the magazine should appeal to a much larger group of people.
Then your transformation of the magazine, and I guess it's inextricable, but you try to think of there is a growing food movement. You are following it, and yet you are also leading it as well.
Well, I mean, I was really lucky because I did not change the magazine. I walked in there, and what I encountered with the staff of Gourmet was the most passionate, knowledgeable, wonderful group of people who, when I said in the first meeting, we can do anything we want with the magazine, what do you think we should do? I didn't speak again for a few hours because they had all the same ideas that I did. So together, we had this notion of, let's talk about what's happening to farmers. Let's talk about what science is doing to food. Let's talk about, you know, is genetic engineering a good thing or a bad thing? And let's go out and find writers who have never talked about food before and say, what interests you? What do you want to write about? For me, it was the most exciting thing to suddenly be in this group of like-minded people, all of whom wanted people to care about as much about food as we did, wanted everybody to be as excited about it, and wanted cooks to know what was going on with their food. Food changed dramatically over the past 25 years. So, I mean, you know, food processing, agribusiness, all of that had a profound effect on what we eat. And we felt like, yeah, you know, food is delicious and it's wonderful and we have to have great recipes and we want to have great writing, but we also want cooks to have the tools to feed their families as healthfully and as well as possible.
Save Me the Plums is the name of Ruth Reichel's new memoir. It is her gourmet memoir, and it is published by Random House. With that excitement from the staff, was there pushback from the rich who were getting the magazine?
If I had known one bit more about management, about magazines, I would have known that what they were asking me to do was the hardest thing you can do, which is change a magazine without offending the devoted readers who continually write in and say, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
Right.
There was huge pushback from older readers. I hand wrote letters. Every time somebody wrote in and said, hate what you're doing to the magazine, hate what you're doing to the magazine, I would handwrite them a letter and say, I understand. I'm so sorry. Please stick with us. Please keep writing. Tell me what you like. Tell me what you don't like. And, you know, there were things that we changed. For instance, there was something called The Last Touch, which had been the last page of Gourmet since the very beginning. It was five very simple recipes on one page. When I asked Ann Stewart, who was the executive food editor and who was at the magazine for 30-some years, I said, you know, do you think people would mind if we got rid of The Last Touch? And she said, oh, no. And the kitchen, the cooks would be so happy because they hate doing those recipes. And we got rid of it. And 2 years later, people were still saying, bring back The Last Touch. We brought back The Last Touch. The magazine, we all felt, we were the stewards of the magazine, but it wasn't ours. It really belonged to the readers. And so it's an honor to have that kind of feedback and that give and take with the readers. So, you know, we did lose some readers, but eventually I think most people came along with us. You know, at the point that the magazine closed, we had the highest circulation in the magazine's history. So we did manage to get a lot of new readers without losing too many of the older ones.
The magazine had been around for 60 years before you walked through the
right door.
Obviously, the New York Times had been around for far longer than that when you become the restaurant critic. Is there a correlation that when you come in and you have a different voice of how people respond
yes,
to that?
Yes, I mean, it is absolutely the same thing. I mean, when I got to the New York Times, and I was a New Yorker, but I had been in California for 20 years, and we got mountains of letters that said, you know, send her back to California, who needs her. One of the great things about writing about food is it's very emotional for people. They feel a connection. And when you get a change of critic, it hits people hard. Generally, people are resistant to that change early on. And then eventually, if you're lucky, they come around. And if you're not lucky, you get fired.
This was not that long ago, and yet it is the tail end of the golden age of magazines. And what you were paid is astonishing. And then just the lifestyle that they expect of you.
Yes. In many ways, it's a Cinderella story. I mean, my husband and I are both journalists. I mean, not only had we never made much money, we literally did not know that people in journalism earned that kind of money. I mean, it was really, I did not ask, what are you paying? And, you know, when my agent told me what the salary was, I literally dropped the phone. And I said, you know, that can't be right. And it came with a clothing allowance, right, a driver, a car. They literally paid for everything. And that is all kind of ludicrous excess, and it doesn't really matter. But the part of it that is amazing is we also had enough money so we could go to any writer and say, I don't care what your fee is. You know, David Foster Wallace, Pat Conroy, Julian Barnes, Ann Patchett, any writer, their fee was not a deterrent. We could go to great photographers. I mean, you know, collectible photographers, mm-hmm, and say, we have this interesting idea to do a piece. Would you consider doing it? And that was what so extraordinary. And, you know, the other thing that was extraordinary about what Condé Nast allowed me to do, and this is why I thought it was important to write this book, because those days are really never coming again. But we did one cover where I went, I mean, I suddenly realized, oh my God, chefs are rock stars. And we should get a Rolling Stone photographer, the guy who does those covers, mm-hmm, and we should get him to shoot a group of chefs as if they're rock stars. And we got an artist to make instruments out of kitchen utensils. And we got this, you know, all the really great chefs, Suzanne Gowen, Eric Repair, a group of great chefs to be a band. We shot it as if it was a Rolling Stone cover. And when I showed it to James Truman, who was my boss, he looked at it and he said, this will be the worst selling issue in Gourmet's history, but you should do it anyway because it's an important moment and nobody has pinpointed it. Nobody today would say to an editor, this is going to tank, but do it anyway. It was a different idea of what a magazine was. James and Cy really thought of magazines as historic. I mean, to them, it was important that as a magazine, you were saying what was going on at that moment in time so that down the road, someone would look back and be able to look at that cover and say, this is that moment.
But there isn't the realization that it's not sustainable, especially with the internet coming down the line. And the fact that you were even having trouble working in a website for the magazine.
Yes. And I think that is the tragedy of Condé Nast, that for all the prescience, and Cy Newhouse was a genius in his way, but for all that, he could not envision a digital future. I think it was hard for anyone. I mean, we're now so in the middle of this digital time that it's hard to look back and remember that even 10 years ago, we did not all walk around with a computer in our hands 24/7.
Right.
And I think even now, none of us really knows where it's going to end, this digital revolution that we're part of. But there were people in publishing who had a better idea, who saw that, oh my God, this is really going to change the world. Condé Nast was late to that party, and it's a shame.
Well, it was, but it could have been its own brand. The recipes, which were the core, were something that were basically being aggregated.
they were being aggregated, because that size notion was that Epicurus, which aggregated all of the Condé Nast recipes from every publication, it was the biggest food website at the time. And, you know, I was out there fighting and saying, you know, we must have a gourmet.com. When they finally let me have one, they neglected to tell me until the very end that I could have a website, but not my recipes.
As I'm reading, I'm thinking, well, that's just assumed. You would just assume that it's Gourmet Magazine, that the recipes are going to be part of it.
Yes. I was gobsmacked. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't believe it when they said, sorry, your recipes will continue to belong to Epicurus. And, you know, I have to tell you that as I was writing it, I thought, I'm not remembering this right. This can't be true. And I kept calling people up and saying, did this really happen? Did I not make this? Did this really happen? They really didn't let us have our recipes. But what happened was, you know, if you were on gourmet.com and you wanted a recipe, you got shifted over to Epicurus.
The relationship with Cy Newhouse, when you're doing the job over the period of time, there's skirmishes, there's things. But basically, as you say, you had the money and you had the ability to do what you wanted.
It was a dream. I honestly believe that Cy Newhouse was the last publisher in America who genuinely believed that when you gave people a quality product, they would appreciate it. And he never asked us to cut corners. You know, I did not believe when I went there that they were really going to leave me alone. They left me alone. Even though, you know, Gourmet was kind of run like a little hippie commune inside this very traditional structure, all they cared about was, you know, is the magazine good? For a long time. And then pressures started showing up.
So let's get to those pressures. At what point did you start to see the writing on the wall, which you outline in the book, is that the writing on the wall for you is that you would be fired. It wouldn't be that the magazine would go away completely.
Yeah, I still am stunned that Gourmet doesn't exist. It was almost 70 years old when Condé Nast closed Gourmet, and it still saddens me enormously. And what I thought was, I thought at some point they will fire me. As the recession started closing in and we really saw our ads go down, 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 and I started to think, okay, you know, this is going to come to an end. But part of what I wanted to talk about in the magazine is, you know, as I matured, suddenly I really was trying very hard to save the magazine, to save my staff. I feel like I kind of grew up, you know. I mean, there was this wonderful moment where we could do anything we wanted. And then suddenly it was, okay, I better do whatever I need to do to try and help my publisher, to try and get more ads. This publication really matters. I'll do anything to save it. And I suddenly found myself spending an awful lot of time on ad sales, doing TV shows, because they really helped our bottom line.
Mm-hmm. The idea of the ads is really interesting because it's the type of ad of things that you were saying no to prior.
Well, I mean, there were things I never said yes to.
Sure.
But, you know, as time goes on and you're watching those ad pages go down, and, you know, that is pretty much the story of what's happened to print media today. People across print, I mean, you know this, Joe. I mean, people across print media are doing things that they would not have countenanced 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
One of the things that you write about in the book that I found really surprising, I mean, not surprising so much, but the obvious question, you say, well, it seems like somebody else would want to buy the magazine. And you had people calling you saying, well, what can we do to save it?
Yes. And Cy would not sell the magazine. And my guess is that he hoped to bring it back at some point. You know, he had brought back many magazines over time.
Vanity Fair,
House and Garden.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that he hoped to bring the magazine back at some point. But, you know, the media landscape changed enormously. And, you know, we're looking at a very, very different time now for magazines, where editors everywhere are looking for revenue wherever they can find it. Increasingly, by doing other things. I mean, you look at, you know, newspapers who are increasingly relying on food, ironically, as a huge revenue stream.
What impact do you think the passing of Gourmet has had on food literature, on the writing of food?
You know, I mean, I actually think that we are in, at this moment, a golden age of food writing. It's just not appearing in Epicurean publications. It's appearing everywhere.
Right.
I think that some of the things we did, like getting literary writers like David Foster Wallace to write for the magazine, made people who publish mainstream publications suddenly think, oh, you know, food is an interesting topic. Maybe we should be looking at it. The investigative pieces we did, you know, Barry Esterbrook's piece on the tomato slaves. Those kind of pieces, I think, made food become not a niche subject anymore. And so now what you have is food is very much a part of, newspapers cover it in really interesting ways. All kinds of, you know, The New Yorker does great food stuff. The Atlantic has like a brilliant food writer. I mean, you have, suddenly the landscape has gotten larger. So I think that would have been inevitable anyway. I mean, I don't think we did that.
Right.
I think that food has become part of popular culture in a way that it just wasn't. And a lot of that is because of food television. You know, it made an entire generation interested in food in a way that they never would have been before. But I also think that, you know, we have a generation of young people who understand that eating is an ethical act and, you know, care passionately about, you know, the impact of their food choices on the planet. And all of that makes food, you know, a really viable topic for just about anyone.
So with this book done and that chapter closed, then how are you now continuing the conversation?
Well, I still write about food. I feel like, you know, I have been on book tour now for this
forever
for this book for a while. And, you know, that in itself has been a really, for me, interesting way of continuing the conversation. You know, I'm very interested at the moment in, you know, justice for food workers. You know, here in New York, we're hoping that we're going to actually pass legislation to change the draconian laws for farm workers. You know, there's a lot to be done. And, you know, at this point, you know, for me, a lot of it is just passing it on to the next generation.
The book is Save Me the Plums, My Gourmet Memoir. It is published by Random House. Ruth Reichel, what a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you, Joe. This has been a real pleasure.
Such a beautiful conversation. Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program Bookmark Us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.